It's been a jolly good week for our latest guest on Soundtrackin', whose new film, 1917, has just landed him a couple of gongs for Best Film and Director at the Golden Globes, along with a handful of nominations for BAFTA Awards. I am, of course, talking about the wonderful Sam Mendes, who joined me for a chat at London's Imperial War Museum towards the end of last year. Now, in case you don't know, 1917 tells the story of two soldiers in World War One, charged with delivering a critical message to fellow troops, and is based on a first-hand account told to Sam by his grandfather. Remarkably, the action is shot to appear like one continuous two-hour take. The fact that he pulls it off in such convincing fashion is thanks in no small part to the efforts of legendary cinematographer Roger Deakins. 1917 has the most extraordinary score written by Thomas Newman, who also worked with Sam on American Beauty and his Bond films. And it's with Thomas's title cue from the movie that we begin. Sam Mendes, welcome back to Soundtrackin'. Well, I say welcome back. You've been on another show that I did, but not quite Soundtrackin'. So welcome to Soundtrackin'.
I'm so sorry. I'm coughing away. And you can hear the echo in here because we're in the dome of the Imperial War Museum, which is a little bit like the War Room in Dr. Strangelove.
I think this is the most grand room we've ever recorded one of these in. It's extraordinary, but it sounds wonderful as well. If only the walls could talk as to what went on here.
Yeah, and it's quite a movie to be here, actually.
Did you spend a lot of time here in research at all? Because this is one of the places George Mackay, one of your cast, was saying that he spent time in terms of...
Yeah, you know, we were here a couple of days. It has an incredible resource, incredible archive.
Yeah.
And because most of the war, really what I was looking for was not historical research in the conventional sense. Mm. Obviously, there's photographs. You know, the wars are very, very well documented. What I wanted was first-person accounts of the war, of which they've collected an enormous number here. Because, of course, this was a war that, you know, it was not recorded very much at the time, and there was no newsreel, and things were being reported in a not entirely accurate way during the war because the government didn't want the men, the potential soldiers, to not enlist. It's only after the war that that the truth began to emerge. So, yeah, I was looking for first-person accounts, diary entries. They have a lot of straight-to-camera video of men not talking about their experiences until their 60s or 70s. Which are amazing and really moving. So this is a pretty amazing resource, this place.
And did you find something here connected to music? Was that where there was a story you discovered about?
We did, yes. That was a nice segue. Yeah, it was here that I encountered a story, a first-person account of written by a soldier, a private or a corporal in the army, who stumbled on a concert in the woods. It's very simple. It's written in very plain language. And he stumbles on a battalion sitting down and listening to one soldier playing the piano. It's a piano that's been looted from a French farmhouse. And he talks about it playing a nocturne by Debussy, the man playing this. And he said he realized in that moment that he hadn't heard music for 2 years. And he describes it as the most beautiful thing he'd ever heard. And it just spellbound him. And I thought, what an amazing scene, potentially. So I had that in the back of my mind. And in this story, there seemed to be a natural moment for something like that. And then that became not a Debussy nocturne, because I felt it wasn't quite credible that there would be a piano happens to be sitting in the woods. So that became a soldier singing a song on his own. But it took me a while to work out what the song was, and I couldn't quite work it out. And then I was driving back with my wife, Ali, and listening to Radio 3 in the car. And somebody played an old folk song sung by Andreas Scholl, or his version of a song, which is, you know, will be familiar in various other versions. It's been recorded by Johnny Cash. And in fact, there's a version of it on YouTube sung by Ed Sheeran called I Am a Poor Wayfaring Stranger. And the arrangement was unbelievably beautiful.
There's no sickness, toil, nor danger in that bright world to which I go.
Obviously, Andreas Scholl has the most incredible voice. And in fact, I used an Andreas Scholl piece, a piece of Vivaldi that he sings, Inspector. So I'm a big fan of his, the sort of extraordinary purity and intensity of his voice. And I found it, and I tried singing it as Andreas Scholl does as a countertenor, but it sounded it didn't sound quite right without the arrangement. So that just became a single voice, tenor voice, singing alone in the woods. And it's one of the moments in the film that I think is when the film gets, you know, a bit more lyrical. It's one of the quieter moments in the film. And I was very conscious that I didn't want to lock the audience into a kind of monotonous pace, you know, and just endless sort of racing forwards. And for reasons that I won't go into, give the movie away, but at this point in the story, he's just been, I mean, so close to death on so many occasions. He feels almost as if he's died and these people are ghosts.
Yeah, he's hallucinating almost. Totally. And the performance is like really, it's really special because it's really tender and it's not show-offy and it's just pitched perfectly.
Well, it's a very good young actor called Joss Slovak who I had to, when I worked with him on the song, which I did very, you know, briefly, I had to make sure that he took out all contemporary vocal stylings, and he said, I'm not doing any, am I? And
oh, wow.
You know, you're so unaware, I think, of the way that people, you know, to try and sing something very plainly with almost no vibrato as well. Don't sound like a trained singer is what I was trying to say, but sing in tune, you know. You become aware of how rarely you hear a voice used that way.
Yeah.
You know, because the goal always is to sound produced, you know.
Yeah, perfect.
And kind of, yeah, perfect or, you know, have personality. And
yeah.
Somehow the song doesn't speak through you. But the thing about folk music is it's, you know, it's handed down from generation to generation. And it's the song that you're listening to, the song that plays the singer in a way. And
it's the words, isn't it? It's storytelling, yeah. Isn't it? That's the thing. It's kind of... You know, that's what folk music is. It's about telling stories lyrically.
Yeah.
You know, and melodically and yeah.
And also, you know, this song is really about life and death and it's a beautiful piece of music.
I'm going to see my father. I'm going.
Was it easy to, you know, in terms of you've got that history and you've got with a number of collaborators on this film, be that Roger Deakins and stuff, but with music and your score and working out how you wanted the film to sound on a score level, was that easy to work out? Did you know what you wanted or was there a lot of conversations?
No, it was one of the most difficult movies to score I've ever experienced. Wow. It's because music operates in a different way in this movie than any I'd experienced before, because it's a one continuous take and it's 2 hours long, just one shot effectively. It's a very, very present tense film, and so the scoring, a lot of the time you're very aware with music that it comments on the acting. It gives you distance or it gives a kind of energy that is not necessarily emerging out of the picture. So we talked a lot, Tom Newman and I, about a very kind of austere ambient underscore a lot of the time, keeps you kind of holding your breath, but doesn't comment on what's going on, doesn't say it's good or bad. So there are some pretty intense emotional scenes that are not scored at all, or barely scored. And then the music emerges in a much more expressionistic and grand way at times when you don't necessarily expect it. So it, as a overall dynamic, you know, in other words, if you were to listen to the score as a whole, of all the scores I've worked on with him, it goes the quietest and the loudest. You know what I mean? And there's not much in between.
Yeah.
It's really an amazing piece of composition. And it was hard to try and find the right tone.
Thank you.
But it's also the thing, because it's a period film, so, you know, it's set in a certain time, but trying to avoid that cliche of it, you know, as well, in terms of, you know, it's kind of fighting against almost what that one song has to be.
Yes.
The purity of that time, of the voice, the score very much feels like it's got a real timeless quality to it, and it's very clever, and it works, I think, brilliantly.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's an amazing score, and I think you're right. You know, it's a contemporary film. It's not a historical period piece. You know, I didn't want something that felt that like it was written in 1917. I felt something that I wanted something that's written now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we use all the contemporary bells and whistles of a big cinema experience, you know, from camera to sound to music. And yet, you also have to not go too far in that direction. You don't want it to sound too groovy, too funky, too. And also, you know, very aware, having worked on two Bond movies with Tom, too Bondian as well. And the Bondian swagger, that sense that we know, you know, when he kicks into gear, you know, he's the man.
Yeah.
That simply couldn't exist in this movie.
It's the opposite.
You know,
these are
accidental heroes.
Yeah.
If they're even heroes, I mean, they're operating on instinct. And they must never seem to be, you know, action men or entirely in control of what they're doing. Even at the point where they do the most extraordinary things, their hands are shaking, you know, they're adrenalized, their hearts are pounding, and they're kind of an inch away from death. So trying to balance the demands of a, you know, a big cinema movie that you want people perched on the edge of their seat with, you know, some level of realism about who these people are, not falling into either historical period cliches or action movie cliches. Mm. That was something we were aware of.
I was just trying to find my notes because
a minute ago it said Kevin Smith, and I thought, don't ask me Kevin Smith's questions. Eyesight.
No, but the first thing that I wrote, like as the film started, was score is stunning. It's not time specific.
Wow. Oh, that's first, interesting. Yeah.
Which is the first thing that I wrote from the first piece of music that I heard.
Yeah, interesting.
And then the one thing that I love as well is that wonderful mix that you have of like the sound design and the score, because there's things like the sound of the crows, you know, and all that kind of stuff, that it's just seamless. And sometimes the music can be, it's so subtle that you don't even realize that it's there, but then a sound will come in and it'll go, oh, well, there was, you know, and that's so clever, I think, as well.
Well, I think we use two or three key moments. It's when the music stops that you really, you know, that's how you express silence sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you need to build up the noise before, immediately before you feel.
Yeah.
Although at one point he says it's bloody quiet, isn't it? And and there is music playing. But the music expresses the silence, you know.
Yeah.
Not an easy thing to do. You say again?
Music expressed in silence.
It's weird and counterintuitive, but this movie is, in many ways, that you feel silence because you hear a crow in the distance or a dog barking in the distance. Pure silence is very difficult to express in movies because you're constantly, you know, you're not almost ever in pure silence. And certainly in movie theaters, you know, there's rustling and people eating popcorn and, you know, someone coming through the door from the toilet and air conditioning and all these other things. So you're fighting against, you know, peripheral sound, which I think is something that's not talked about very much, but I talk about a lot in the theater, you know, that you're trying to create silence. Even now, sitting in this room, I can hear, you know, I can hear the buzzing of a generator and, you know, all these other little things that go on. So you have to create a feeling of space around a noise. You know, I have a favorite bird call in the movie. It's the call of the loon, you know, which is one of these amazing lake birds. And the call is very, very haunting and strange. And you feel suddenly the space, you can hear it echoing across space. So you're expressing the distance beyond where we see, because it's a very eye level movie. You know, you're with the characters very intimately a lot of the time in places where they can't see what's beyond.
Yeah.
They're down in a trench or they're in a dugout and they're in a hole and they can't see, you know, and they don't, neither do they want to be because they feel exposed. So sometimes you're down in the trench with them and you hear this sound beyond and you realize the vastness of the land just beyond their vision.
Yeah.
And that's a way of using sound to express space in a way that's, you know, hopefully unconscious for an audience. You feel it. You don't think about it.
Yeah.
You're not drawing attention to it, but trying to express silence is one of the most difficult things in film.
I've got a couple of cues that I wanted to speak about particularly. One of the is the piano that kind of comes in as they're kind of almost kind of traversing the crater.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's
yes. Yeah, so, I mean, Tom was very, you know, he said, am I allowed to write music here? Well, yeah. You know, I mean, it was like, because, you know, it's so much of it at that point has been ambient, you know, yeah. Huge, just big bottom end tones and strange. It's almost like a sort of waves of nausea, you know, and I was very conscious both in the way that we shot No Man's Land and the way that we scored No Man's Land, that there's always a danger in movies that you're using, you know, one of the greatest catastrophes in world history to sort of piggyback on it, you know, to tell an action story or yeah. or an entertainment. And there's a large part of the movie which I wanted to sort of bear witness to this thing. Mm. I wanted to bear witness to No Man's Land. And I wanted the music to do the same thing. I didn't want to do, you know, look at this, isn't this terrible or isn't this awful? Just it sits there like a kind of, like a sickness, you know. And it comes in these big sort of heaving waves of sound. And suddenly there's this strange, haunting figure that Tom picks out on the piano. And in a way, it's the first moment in the movie, if you look at it carefully, that the camera really detaches from the central character. The camera floats across this awful, fetid kind of lake of bodies and crows, and the characters go further and further away along the far bank, and then gradually they double back and start coming back towards you again, and we rejoin them, and at that point the piano theme develops into something larger. And again, it's connected to the way that the way the camera is relating to the characters, and yeah. Suddenly having heard they're doing every footstep, every breath, they're distant characters, almost far away in the mist. And so music in a way takes some of the pressure off us expecting to see them all the time. It says actually there are going to be other ways to tell this story,
yeah.
Not just following behind them or seeing yeah. them up close. And so it was an important cue in a way.
Different kind of locations, so to speak, that they sort of, you know, go through to try and get to where they're going. I'm so conscious of giving away things while
yeah,
I'm asking
I know.
You questions.
It's difficult to talk about without giving stuff away.
But there's a sort of derelict town with yes. you know that's an inferno basically, and that's I could watch hours of that kind of just it's just so beautifully shot, but kind of getting the sound right for that, where it's a very different landscape and environment that we've been in, and that it's an angry landscape. There's lots going on. There's even the colour of it and all that kind of thing, and thinking about the music or the score slightly differently for that as well.
Yes, I thought it was very... that's the first time the camera detaches entirely from the characters and you don't see them at all. It goes out of a window and floats down into the town. And then eventually we meet up with the character again, who's by that time walking into the town. But the music is also saying, on some level, you know, at this point he's been badly injured and we've lost track of time. It's saying he's doing it. He's keeping going. He's going to make it, you know. So there's this sort of extraordinary feeling of, I don't know, it's really stirring. I find that an incredible, for me, that's the best piece of music Tom's ever written for one of my movies. You know, he calls it The Night Window, and I think it's an amazing piece. Mm. But one of the interesting things that's also going on is there is a slightly sort of magical feeling to it, almost as if he's about to step through the looking glass, you know, into another world.
Yeah.
And it sets up that new visual language, that new landscape, which is the flares going over and the distortion of the light and the shadows and the sense in which the ground is moving underneath him. And then this sort of weird descent, as you say, into hell, really, which is the point at which the story moves away from something more naturalistic and towards something more mythic. You know, it really is like going into the underworld, you know. He's and you wanted this apocalyptic hallucination to be accompanied by music that was its equal.
Yeah. Did you use temp score?
We did, yeah. I mean, we temped it very, very heavily while we were shooting it, because Lee Smith, the editor, was stitching it all together and trying to give me, I wanted as much of a sense of what the final movie might feel like before I shot the next day. So I was able to kind of watch the movie up to the point I was shooting every day or every night. And a lot of that was just trying music out. Sometimes it was very, very clear when it worked, and it was very difficult to get pieces that worked. And when I suggested the piece of temp score for that moment, Lee laughed at me. He said, that's not going to work. And then it did work. Most of the time he was right and I was wrong, but on that occasion I can say that it worked. And it was quite an extreme choice, because I think he thought, oh, this is a moment where we're going to be doing conventional tension thriller scoring, and it's not that at all. It's something quite different, and in a way more ambitious than that.
Yeah, it's so funny hearing people talk about kind of the love-hate relationship with temp score, both of that. Can you just do something that sounds a bit like this, if that's all right? Well, one thing I wanted to ask, as well, I was listening back to our last conversation, and we talked quite in depth about Bond, and in particular that incredible long opening sequence for that Bond film.
Inspector. Yeah.
And I watched it back, and just talking about how brilliantly matched picture and music, and the clever use of that. There's a bit where it's like guitar chords that are the chords of the theme tune.
Yeah.
And you instantly, it's I mean, like you said last time, it's like one of the most iconic, probably the most iconic, you know, theme tune ever. But just the way of using that. And I wanted to ask, because working with Roger on that kind of, you know, and I know that you'd, after Bond, you started to think about this film.
Yes.
And whether that the experience of that kind of idea of what you created with that hugely long opening sequence had given you a bit of a go, actually.
It did give me. Of course, Roger didn't shoot that one. He shot the previous one.
The previous
Roger
one,
shot
sorry,
Skyfall,
yeah.
But the long tracking shot was Inspector, which is shot by Hoyte van Hoytema.
The best named cinematographer ever.
I think his name's Colin or something, really. just made it up. Anyway,
Jeff.
Shot by Colin. Colin Smith, a.k.a. Hoyte. Anyway, that was tremendously enjoyable and really thrilling. And it felt so exciting when we were trying to coordinate thousands of costumed Mexican extras. And Daniel and that kind of dropping an audience down into the middle of this, you know, really sweaty atmosphere and exciting. But yeah, that was a very deliberate. I think a piece of scoring that I'm proud of, because we have these drummers, Tambuco, these Mexican drummers who are brilliant, playing live, and then Tom Newman weaved the Bond theme into the live drumming, and then the theme kind of took over as the drums receded, so. Even though the first 5 minutes doesn't have any conventional scoring, it just has source music. It feels like you've got music going the whole time. I was very pleased about the opening sequence of Spectre, partly because we didn't use scoring all the way through it. I got very frustrated with Skyfall, where I realised that there was something about the opening sequence, impressive though it was, that felt sort of a bit metronomic, like, and we had to score it from beginning to end, which is a long time for action scoring. So I was very conscious of waiting and waiting and waiting till the score began, Inspector, which was in the fight in the helicopter when the helicopter lost control. Then the music comes in, and because you've been sort of deprived of it up to that point, it feels like it has a sort of kicks like a horse at that point. You're like, oh, when it comes in, it feels great. We'll be right back. I did learn a fair amount. I mean, I learned a lot from the whole Bond experience. But one of the things was, you know, how good music can be when you've had a break from it. You know what I mean? When you don't hear it for long periods and you trust silence. There's a great temptation to overscore, and particularly in a big movie like a Bond movie. And it taught me, you know, to have the confidence to wait a little longer.
How much do you think your theatre experience kind of informs you as a filmmaker?
Oh, gosh, I don't really know, because I don't know any other way, you know.
Yeah.
But in terms of this movie, it informed me a whole lot, yeah. Really, a great amount. Because I was, first of all, I'm not unfamiliar with rehearsing 8 weeks and then saying to a bunch of actors, right, you know, off you go, I'll see you in 2 hours. You know, there's an audience out there waiting to watch you. And watching an evening and then trying to judge the rhythm and the shape and the pace of the whole rather than breaking it up into its component parts. And, you know, movies are tiny little bits and you impose the pace and the rhythm in editing.
Yeah.
So that muscle that I normally use for theatre to try and judge the shape of something, I was using every day for this movie, because I had to get a perfect take before I could move on. And I also had to judge, is it too long? Is it boring? Is it repetitive? That pause he takes there, will I be frustrated by that in 5 months' time when I'm in a cutting room? Will the scene be scored? You know, how am I going to, how's it going to slot into the whole? Dare I take the time that this scene takes, you know? And it needed a certain amount of, you know, what David Fincher calls intestinal fortitude to just sort of, you know, get through each day without second guessing oneself, without thinking, oh my God, that scene I shot where he comes out of the farmhouse and walks to the barn, he seems to take forever and nothing's being said and I can't cut it out. Am I mad? You know?
No.
But it, you know, I felt it was working, and you know, in the end, I think that instinct comes from feeling what an audience can and can't take in a live experience.
Absolutely, it's lovely to have things have the pace to it. I think is wonderful, because it feels real, if that makes sense.
Yeah, know? I mean, you know, the life's not always interesting, but you know, the weird thing is, it's amazing if you feel a sense of potential threat, how long you're on the edge of your seat and how closely you watch the image, because you just don't know where that's going to come from.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you do have to remind the audience pretty consistently throughout, okay, this is where we are, this is where we've got to get to, this is the dangers.
Yeah.
And that does happen pretty consistently throughout, you know, that they remind each other, this is what we've got to do. We must make sure this doesn't happen. And really in reminding each other, they're reminding us as well as we watch, you know, this is what could happen to them. But I'm very proud that in the first half of this movie, what effectively are the action sequences are basically a rat, which I won't explain what happens with the rat, but, you know, and a plane. And I won't explain what happens with the plane, but both of them lead to pretty immense, you know, and life-changing incidents. And they're not at all where you expect the dangers to come from. And in that respect, it's constantly, I hope, defying what your expectations are of a war movie. And, you know, there's no combat in it. There's very little bloodshed.
Yeah.
But in terms of feeling like you're there, I hope it succeeds.
It was interesting hearing Roger say that working with you on Jarhead actually had kind of been had helped inform elements of this in a way, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different movie in lots of ways. But in other ways, I mean, for a start, it meant because we were working on a war movie, we had a chance to talk about our favourite war movies. So we already knew that 15 years ago that, you know, we'd sat down and watched together the Battle of Algiers and Come and See and, you know, No Man's Land and, you know, and then you add to that the obvious ones, Apocalypse Now or Grand Illusion and these things. And so we didn't really watch any other movies on this one at all, because we already knew each other's tastes in war movies.
Do you watch them together?
A couple of them we did, yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, with movies, normally I would screen movies for crews and say, look, this is the feeling I want, and, you know, look at the color palette or I don't know what it, whatever it is that you're going for, there'll be some element that you want to draw people's attention to when you're making this movie. But this one, we didn't do anything of that at all, because it just, we kept thinking, who else? We couldn't find anything that was like this film. And I'm not saying that in a sort of, I'm not blowing my own trumpet. It's just a simple fact. There isn't a movie that works quite in this way. Because even the greatest examples, and there are some great ones, of very subjective filmmaking, like, for example, Son of Saul, you know, is shot on very, very long lenses. You really don't see, you see him, the central character, but you see barely anything except the merest hint of what lies beyond. But because you know the horrors that probably are there, it's incredibly evocative and very powerful. But it's very different to this movie, which is shot on a 40mm lens, which is, you know, a pretty conventional lens, really. It sees a lot, but not everything. And it's certainly not into, we're not in Revenant Birdman territory, where you're on these 18mm lenses where you see everything, you know, and you're very, very wide. It's somewhere in its own place. And there was no particular rule to the relationship between camera and actor. It just sort of, you know, we just talked it through, and it was basically operating on instinct. So we didn't have anything else we could look at.
It's good in a way.
It's very good, and it's what you want, but it's also slightly scary. you can't, when you're in, you know, when you're up against it on set, one has a tendency to think, how did Kubrick do it in such and such, you know, how did Lean do it? But there was nothing.
In a complete curveball, one thing we didn't talk about last time that I have to talk to you about, it was musical theatre.
Yes, musical theatre.
Cabaret.
Yep.
What's your attraction to that, though, that world? Because I love how you have so many different hats, you know, in terms of, you're feeding your creativity, I think, through all these wonderful different outlets and kind of...
I have a constantly evolving relationship with the musical theatre. Sometimes I think it can be incredible, and sometimes I think it's literally the stupidest thing ever invented. I'm serious. You know, there are times when I find it almost impossible to watch, because I just think, what are you doing? You know, you're singing, you've got a mic on, you know, you're singing in a voice no one ever uses. There's a big band there, and it's sort of packaged emotion, and it can be the most sentimental, the most, you know, and musically it often leaves something to be desired. But then when it works, you know, the best of it, Sondheim, occasional Rodgers and Hammerstein, Candor and Ebb, you know, or Hamilton, for example, you think, well, this is the best form of theatre there is. I mean, it isn't musicals, it's music theatre, you know. But in order to get to Hamilton, I was very struck, you know, Lin-Manuel is so kind of marinated in the history of musical theatre. You can see all that knowledge in the way that he's constructed that show, that even though it's cutting edge in so many ways, without all that knowledge of musical theatre and all the techniques of musical theatre and choreographers and directors and writers and the history of musicals, he wouldn't be able to do that. So I very much admired the fact that he was using the genre to reinvent the genre rather than coming at it as a novice. He'd really done his homework.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14. They placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain. Well, the word got around and said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
But I don't think I'm that good at it. I know it sounds silly for someone who's
won
done
awards
the musical.
For it.
Yes, meaningless, as you know. Occasionally, I found my way towards something that really, you know, feels like it's quite personal.
Yeah.
And I think cabaret was one of those things. But a lot of the time, you know, the show is being governed by automated machinery, which is not my favorite thing.
Yeah. Brute is sitting alone in your room. Come here, the music
play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. When I go, I'm going like a star boy and lifting from cradle to tomb. Isn't that wonderful? Life is a cabaret, only a cabaret, and I love a cabaret.
I think that particular one, I mean, I remember watching my mum in that when I was a kid, actually.
Wow.
And in a kind of local production of it, yeah.
What did she play?
She was only on in the she was only in she, the in the kind of chorus for that, yeah. One, but then the one that I do remember kind of more vividly is a really smaller known musical called Charlie Girl.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
Then Sweet Charity she was, yeah, in as well, and she played Nancy and Oliver, and I've got this picture of her in my hall of her all draped in Nancy. I was 3 and my dad took me to see it and in a local town hall, and I thought Bill Sykes had killed my mum. My dad was like, it's just pretend.
Oh.
And it's such a kind of...
That's heartbreaking.
Such an amazing memory that I have.
Yeah,
one of
yeah.
The few of
can
that
you remember
kind of age.
It?
Yeah, absolutely. I can remember the kind of weird old seats and where we were sat. And,
wow.
And my dad kind of putting his arm around and kind of almost pre-warning me, going, this is just, it's just pretend.
Yeah.
But
well,
I
there's
mean,
a root. There's a root of your fascination, you know.
Maybe, yeah.
But also,
my mum died.
What's your mum being killed by Bill Sykes? Yeah. Yeah, never recovered.
But you're right about that thing. Like, there's some that get it really right, and there's others that it's
yeah.
So. It's just yeah, like it's just saccharine. It's
yeah.
Just.
It can be a painful thing to
yeah.
Watch.
I want to leave, if that's all right, just because purely selfishly it means that we can play some of Thomas's extraordinary American Beauty score, which
great.
I think is one of the best scores ever written. Thank you. I right in thinking that there's some stuff that didn't make it into the film that is around music, but a record shop?
Oh, American Beauty. Yeah. I thought a record shop in 1917. Yeah. No, I'm not sure about that. Yeah. There is, yes. Well remembered. Yeah, there's a scene set in a record shop. He goes in and he buys all the records that he should have bought when he was a teenager. This is Lester, who's then, of course, in his 40s. So I seem to remember him buying, you know, Dark Side of the Moon and, you know, bringing it all back home and Led Zepp 2 or something. and the record shop assistant, you know, looks at him. He's got sort of nasal piercings and straight hair, and he goes, "Catching up?" And Lester goes, "Yep," like that. And it was a really great little scene. I just thought, what a great little scene, because it's exactly what he's doing. He's like, "Yeah, you've got it. I'm going to relive my youth, and I don't care. I'm going to start smoking dope. I'm going to listen to all those records that I should have listened to when I was young, you know." And I think there was a line about, you know, he said, "I was too busy listening to Three Dog Night" or something like that to listen to Dark Side of the Moon. And I mean, Alan Ball, who wrote it, is great with music, I think. And, yeah, and is a muso himself. I mean, a real music lover, and wrote a lot of musical references into the script, some of which, you know, I didn't use, but some of which I did.
And last thing I wanted to ask you, because this is your first, 1917 is your first screenplay that you've written.
Yeah.
And if it was a different experience for you making a film that you've written.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I you know, I feel like it's much more moving. I mean, when you sit down, it's a blank page, you know, and weeks, months later, suddenly there are all these people there to fulfill effectively your vision. It just feels different. It feels more personal. You feel more vulnerable at times. You feel more responsible for their state of mind, happiness, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it just felt different from the beginning, this one. Also, you know, the story itself is personal to me. You know, it's part of my family history. So there is that as well. I felt I was sort of somehow going back to my childhood when I was told these stories. And that makes you very much more connected emotionally to the whole experience. Plus, there were the odd things of, you know, the unusual circumstances of shooting, you know, one continuous shot and all this stuff, and being very close to home. So it was different for all those reasons, and really, really rewarding because of it, I think.
Yeah. You've made a really very special film.
Thank you, Edith.
So great to chat to you. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you. Pleasure. Real pleasure.
From the score to 1917, that's Kwasil Wood by Thomas Newman, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the fantastic Sam Mendes. My huge, huge thanks to Sam for taking the time to talk to us. 1917 is on general release now and is an absolutely stunning creative achievement. We'll put a Spotify playlist up for the show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to subscribe and catch up with all 180 odd episodes of our wee podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do check out our YouTube channel as well, which is where you'll also be able to watch next week's guest, as well as listen to him as usual on the podcast. Next week we have the fabulous Mr. Bruce Springsteen, joined by the director of his film released last year, Western Stars, Tom Zimney. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.